We're about to begin. At this time, we will have another presentation by Mr. Melvin Edwards. And today he will be speaking on art and architecture, the relationship of art to architecture from a cultural perspective. And to introduce him will be Daniel Khanna, a student in the art school.
Hello, my name is Daniel Khanna. I'm a first year fine arts major at the Arts, Architecture, and Planning. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce our next guest speaker. He has been a renowned sculptor whose impact has been felt in the art world for the last several decades. This artist has a long record of teaching experience, including such colleges as the University of Connecticut, the Livingston College, the Mason Gross School of the Arts, the Orange County Community College, the California Institute of the Arts, and he is now teaching at Rutgers University in New Jersey. His sculptures have been shown in a very large number of art centers, including the Studio Museum in Harlem, the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney Museum of American Art, the Jersey City Museum, the American Indian Community House, the California Afro-American Museum, the Anti-Apartheid United Nations in Paris, and many, many others. Moreover, he has also had varied exhibits in such colleges as Dartmouth, Rutgers, Morgan State University, and others, including Cornell, where his work is on permanent collection at the Herbert Johnson Museum. He has researched the art and architecture of Africa and diaspora extensively in such places as Ghana, Nigeria, Mexico, France, Egypt, Nicaragua, Martinique, Cuba, Senegal, and the Ivory Coast. His career has not gone without recognition. He has received various awards, including the Fulbright Fellowship to Zimbabwe, the Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship, the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, the Santa Barbara Art Association Award, the John Hay Whitney Fellowship, and others. His professional activities span... His professional activities span from lectures, colleges, and museums nationwide, to acting as consultants for various exhibits, to being on the boards of numerous art museums, to being sent to Lagos as a delegate representing the U.S. at the Festac Cultural Festival. Basically, what I could say, can't even really skim this man's accomplishments. And just please allow me to introduce Mr. Melvin Edwards.
Thank you very much. Sometimes it scares you when your resume gets loose on you. But that just means that I'm probably a little older than I used to be. It's a pleasure to be at Cornell, and I was here back in 1969 for the first time, making a piece of sculpture which is here and in the permanent collection. But I made friends here then, and some of them are around, some of them have retired, and times change for all of us, but it's very nice to be here, especially in these circumstances, and to see the human progress and development, which just by the presence of so many people who will do things that will make the world different, that they're here, and and that's optimistic. I'm going to sort of do a double kind of thing. I'm presuming that I am a representative of culture. I'm even going to presume that you understand that I may have experienced architecture for no other reason that occasionally I've lived in it or walked through it or something like that. The actual relationships have been more direct than that, but why don't we just start with basics? And so I'd like to start by dedicating this little talk or presentation to a whole bunch of people. As someone mentioned quite rightly yesterday, that we should first thank our ancestors, and I can do that in many respects and feel quite natural doing it. But first of all, I would thank my father and a very small diagonal hallway that he once constructed in our house in Houston. And I'm pretty sure you couldn't call it architecture, because my grandmother said, why did he make it straight? Why do you have to make it go that way? And when I say hallway, it probably was no wider than this, so you've got to understand, wider or longer than about 6 feet, so that in certain grandiose ideas of what architecture is, well, that wouldn't play. But for me, it gave me a little bit of awareness that if you make spaces differently than people expect, they affect you, your thinking. And in my case, I think I retained some notion that if the hallway is diagonal, you get to places with a different speed and a different state of mind. Anyway, I'm going to ignore a lot of my experience and a lot of my resume. On the other hand, I'm going to cover a great deal of it. In other words, I was born in Texas, basically grew up there till the age of 18, except I lived in Dayton, Ohio for 5 years, and at the age of 18, after leaving Texas in a sort of final way, I went to California, and I lived there for 11 years, and then for the last 25 years, I've been in the East, primarily in New York. In other words, I've lived on all three coasts and in the center of the country. And if you're not used to thinking of the Gulf Coast as one of the coasts, it is. For those who are in Alaska, we may have another discussion about the fourth. But what that's meant is I think somehow I gathered some kind of awareness of the variety that's here in this country. In other words, on the little street, one block street that I was in Houston, it was bilingual. It was in Spanish and in English. And some of my earliest memories are, Melvi, Melvi, andale, andale, go home. In other words, me and my friends played at each other's house to such an extent that we had to chase each other out. But what it also means is that while I didn't really learn Spanish at that point, I at least was aware that more than one thing was going on. And in the social dynamics of this society, they couldn't go to the same schools with me because they were classified as white, and the United States was a totally segregated country, at least in the southern states where that was law. And so that was a part of it. What that means to the work that you'll see, I think will become clear as we go. So with that introduction, we can cut out the lights and start the slides. Or I guess I start the slides. So. Is the other one alive too? Okay. Well, I guess the world can start with the sunrise, and the rocks on the left are in Zimbabwe. They are called the balancing rocks, and they're natural phenomena, but for anybody who thinks sculpturally, you'd have to think it just might have to do with somebody's hand. That's also Zimbabwe. and that's also Mother Nature. And that's Zimbabwe. And that's Mother Nature and Great Zimbabwe. Great Zimbabwe is an architectural site in Masvingo in Zimbabwe, which I think dates from around the year 1100. And the country Zimbabwe gets its name from that particular architectural situation. I was also told that the name Zimbabwe means house of stone, and it's a country of extremely interesting geography or geology or angeology. And stones are important, and their whole contemporary art movement is basically based on sculpture made in stone. It's not a traditional movement, but a real contemporary one developed in the last 40 years. The tall kid on the right is me, at 11. And the little kid in the chair is my youngest brother, who's also an artist and lives in Los Angeles. Except now he's about 4 inches taller and equally bigger than me, but he's a painter. In other words, we grew up. In terms of what I always wanted to do, I always wanted to be talented and athletically proficient, and this is one of the things that I never learned how to do. I now live in New York, and of course it's a very important city. Some people call it the most exciting place in the world, and some call it the most dangerous place in the world. And I sort of look over my shoulder both ways just in case either situation may arise. But the important thing about New York is that it's a very multicultural, in the language or the recent idiom, place. And that you come into contact with people from all over the world, all kinds of ideas, and your work is able to benefit from that if you make the effort. One of the things that I happen to use is Chinese New Year, which is always about a month after the Western world's New Year, and my late Christmas cards, New Year's cards, still have a chance of getting to somebody with the idea of celebrating the New Year. I also happen to like the food and culture, and in a course that I teach called Third World Artists, often emphasize the arts of China or Japan or India, and so that's an actuality, a reality in terms of my work. Since my particular community is the African American community, we also have days of celebration, and one of them is in August of every year. And this is from about 1970. For those of us who are my age and are used to be able to get our hair almost out to that far, now we're lucky to have any hair at all, or gray, or. But anyway, the real part of the culture that you can always maintain is your mental facilities, your creativity, and that's a significant part of culture. One of the things that has happened, I guess I should mention by now, I am a sculptor. I work in steel for the most part, and the work is in at least a kind of parallel of patterns or tracks or development. One relatively personal or expressive in the personal sense, and another more in the public sense. I haven't figured out totally the separation, but at least for academic purposes we can deal with it. This is a traditional blacksmith in the village of Asebu in Ghana. And all I know in my family is that there was a great-great-great-grandfather who came from some African country, was sold in New York to a family in Alabama. He was a young adult African-trained blacksmith who then worked throughout slavery and the rest of his life as a blacksmith. He lived to be 106 years old into the early part of this century in Alabama. So, but what place from specifically, we don't know. So sort of whenever I go to Africa, among other things in the sense of research or just personal interest, I try to find out what they call a blacksmith in that place, you know, whether he's a Misha in Shona or a Lagbede in Yoruba, or, you know, the various names, of bunches of them, because there are many languages. Someday I'll get Grandpa's name, so to speak. But in any case, the process continues. This is the staff of Oran Miyan in Ile Ife in Nigeria. And in my first visit to Nigeria, or to Africa, but Nigeria in particular, I went there, and that was important. And if you don't know it, Ile Ife is, for the Yoruba people, similar to Mecca, to Muslims, or the Vatican, or Jerusalem, or, you know, those kind of holy but significant cultural places. And that's Chief Omoregbe Ine, the late chief of the bronze casters of Benin. And he was very helpful. And while I'm a person who didn't go to graduate school, I will just consider my life graduate school. He was one of my real inspirations and mentors. And I first met him in 1971. He passed in 76. But his son and I are still in very good contact. The traditions of sculpture and architecture, art and culture in Benin City are continuous, and they're similar to certain other places on the African continent. For instance, Kumasi in Ghana, or Kikongo places in Zaire, or, you know, they're all over the continent. There are coherent, contemporary continuations of traditional culture. And this happens to be a place that is now personal to me because of spending so much time and contact. And since I work in steel, this street, which you see on his address on the door, Igunirongo, is the street of the bronze casters and blacksmiths. That metalworking process continued in the Americas, specifically in Brazil and Cuba, but other countries as well, but most dominantly in those places. And this is a structure made by a blacksmith in Brazil for me at the request of my wife, who was in Brazil a bit before I was, and she had this made by a traditional blacksmith for a person who worked in metal. In other words, for the processes of Ogun. And the small implements hanging down on the piece are the various tools that a blacksmith would make and or use or for others. This is the first work of mine that you'll see, and it's a piece from 1962, and it's called Fifth Ward, Dark and Horizontal, and it's welded and forged steel. This one is called John Henry, and of course it is dedicated to the steel driving man. The person whose story, at least for me, is that if you want to compete with the industry of the world with what you have in your own physical and mental capacity, it will take a great deal of sacrifice to the extent of working your life away to get it done, but it is possible. Since 1963, there have been a group of pieces that have been called in collective title the Lynch Fragment Series, and they're small pieces that hang on the wall. They are made of welded and forged steel, and there are found objects and objects which are made, so you can't necessarily tell what's found and what's made by me in terms of the parts. But in any case, the significant thing of each piece is its own qualities. This piece is dedicated in particular to the painter from Cuba, Wilfredo Lam. I'll show you a series of pieces from this group of works because that group has been going on for 30 years almost now. They're each very different. They each have different titles, but they're all about a foot high in or thereabouts and have equal kind of projection. Just for example, the piece you saw before was called Catatura, and it was dedicated to a town in Namibia, but really based on a story in the United Nations records of the torture of a group of Namibian nurses who were active working for the independence of Namibia. And they were tortured by the South African authorities who were in control of Namibia at that point. And you don't want to know what the tortures were. Only that they lived is a miracle. And the scars are deep. This one is called Freedom Weapon, and the real weapon is the mind. This one is called Kasinga, and it's because there was a massacre in Angola in the town of Kasinga, again of Namibian refugees. The reason I focused on it is not just collecting things from the newspapers or magazines or something, but it happened on May the 4th, 1978, and that was my birthday. And I don't know what you do on birthdays, but I get a bit reflective about life, and it seems that if a lot of people who were innocent human beings are killed on that day, their life doesn't continue, and mine does. It should make you think. And this one is called Chihuri, and it was actually made in Zimbabwe in 1989 when I was there for 3 months, primarily doing workshops in metal sculpture for the artists there who worked primarily in stone. But this piece came about because one of my visits to a very small village school with the National Gallery's art program. And at this village school, since this outreach program came maybe once or twice a year, they brought out everybody. There was a kind of day of celebration. Well, from somewhere in one of the outlying rural areas, they brought a young man in a horse-drawn cart who was paralyzed throughout half his body. And his father had made him a steel poker, and they would collect plastic empty containers and give them to him, and he'd heat the poker, and he would make things. And he'd made airplanes about this big with all the seats inside. He made lions and giraffes and things. And he had to be carried in the cart because, you know, that was his condition. But it didn't stop his creativity. And I've been like most people. I grumble about the lack of income or the lack of things that I want to happen. But that day in Chihuri, not that that's the only time in my life I've seen that, but that day in that place it was something that I wanted to remember. That this piece doesn't look anything like that, doesn't have too much to do with it. But there is a pointed implement here. Now, this piece is called Chitungwiza. Chitungwiza is important. I think in some of the discussions we've been hearing people talk about urban and suburban life and qualities. Well, in the city of Harare, there's a suburb called Chitungwiza, but it was one of the townships when Zimbabwe wasn't independent. It was one of the places where black people had to live and whites had the real center of the city. Now, of course, the country is independent. People live everywhere. But Chukwueze is the largest growing city or suburb in Zimbabwe at this point. And I met many artists, many very creative people, some of whom have significant international reputations in the world of sculpture. Not so much in the United States, but in Europe and other places in the world. And so this is sort of a little homage to Chukwueze. This one is called Alteration. And in the process of work, many times one develops his ideas one way and going through it makes a change. In the sense of those who see various things here in terms of images that may or may not be, in the idea of creativity and the use of symbols, well, the hammer and the phallus are the same thing. They have a word in Zimbabwe, which I don't know, but its translation for human creativity and development is that the penis or the vagina are the places where people come from. This one's called On the Spot. And this one is called The 12th Day of the 12th Month. But the thing I want to point out here, there's a kind of a spade-shaped or hoe-shaped or heart-shaped form there. And it's a traditional kind of hoe that traditionally in Zimbabwe was made by a blacksmith for working the soil. In the form, if you know how an adze is perpendicular to the end of the haft. But at the same time, it also was a gift at the time of marriage from the man's family to the woman's family. And so it was an indication both of the blacksmith's skill or artistry. It was also important because it symbolized the fertility of the society. And those things are perennially significant anywhere. In discussing art and architecture, you know, in the universities, there are those two courses, the one from the cave to the Renaissance and the one from the Renaissance to next weekend. So this is not quite the cave, but it's rock outcropping in Domboshawa, which is again a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And people in that region have been painting on this rock for about 10,000 years. If you can make out in the upper right-hand corner, the outline of a rhinoceros. Aside from maybe some people surprised that art's been going on that long in that kind of place, some of you people who are involved with the problem of painted surfaces and architecture might want to try and figure out what the paint's made out of. I don't know if Benjamin Moore or any of Sharon Williams or any of those guys that can last 10,000 years. So you tell me. That's Cornell University on the right. And that's a piece I came to make in 1969. And it's called Homage to My Father in the Spirit. But in terms of the structure of the piece, it was nice to see in yesterday's presentation by Mr. Dozier the pyramid at Saqqara, that is the step pyramid, because this is a step triangle. You know. One of the things that happens with artists is that they do a little research sometime. I didn't get to see the pyramid at Saqqara until 1980, but I have been there. But this made me here in 1969 was a mixture of personal and, you might say, a way of paying attention to the importance of structures made in the ancient world. And Imhotep and Zosa had been a part of my study. Now, this is another piece from the period. These pieces, which are very different from the small-scale Lynch fragments. They have to do with geometry and repetition and color and some way of relating to in scale and situation to human beings. This is Harlem at 143rd Street, about 1970, and the piece is called Double Circles, and it was dedicated to Mary McLeod Bethune. This piece is called N'Tri-Tri, and the title is simply a way of linguistically playing with the identification that the piece is a repetition of triangles, but also my freelance way of Africanizing some of the English language, and so I just call it N'Tri-Tri. Every now and then in the history books that have reproduced this, they keep correcting it and taking the N out of the front, but that's the way it goes. They never ask. The important thing in the piece is a little bit of child's play engineering, and that's the it's hard to see, but on the far right there are the two triangles which have a cantilevered structures at the top, and the triangles should fall over because of the weight, but because there's a chain connecting them and they pull one against the other is equal, they balance and stay up. It's like that old child game where you grab your friend's hand and you lean back, and if you aren't overweight, this one's called Felton, and it's dedicated to my mother's family, which is the family of the blacksmith I mentioned earlier. This piece is called Asafokra, and the title comes from the Ghanaian Asafo tradition of painted architecture. Or polychrome architecture, it's more complicated than that, in that it's a place where people have ritually significant activities. The work doesn't look anything like Asafo society houses as far as I know them, but what I was really dealing with was the two ideas of spirit and unity, and my own development of forms through the years, where in some cases geometry and personal or collective significance. One of the other things that Asafo companies often make are banners, quilted kind of or applique kind of banners of significance. You can hardly see it, but there's a galvanized gray chain at the top attached to the red section. It's about 8 feet high there. And in a sense, that's one of the flags that I've been playing with, both metaphorically and otherwise in the work. And this is one of those places from which that kind of spirit comes, and that's Biriwa in Ghana. And the occasion is the welcoming of a group of visitors from the United States back in 1970. So you can see it has nothing to do with the look, but does have to do with, I hope, gaining some of the spirit. My talk's probably going to run a little bit over, but I hope you'll bear with me because I wanted to show you probably too much. This is a piece dedicated to J.B. Washington, who was a little boy when my brothers were little boys and I was a big boy. J.B. Washington went to Vietnam and he didn't come back. And I didn't think he needed to go to that situation, but I didn't just think he didn't need to go to. I didn't think any young persons needed to be subjected to that. And I'm very dubious about various people's military enterprises. By now you may have seen that the use of chain in the work is significant. You probably are thinking for the most part in symbolic and metaphorical terms, and that's fine. And presuming the history of slavery and depression, all of that's true, but you also have to remember that to make a construct a chain by a traditional blacksmith anywhere was an example of extreme skill. The one thing you don't want is anything that you're lifting with the chain is for the chain to break. So that linkages are important both ways. In poetic or artistic terms, it also is used, I guess everybody here is still young enough or old enough to know chain, Aretha Franklin. You know, of course, it's still about connections. And then there's the idea of linkages and continuity. So that as a creative person, the idea of working with a material is always multiple, and it's quite possible that in each particular piece the use or the ideas is different, and it's material for constant thematic point of departure. This is an actual chain actually used as a tool to create an etching. And the etching, for those of you who know graphic art, it's both intaglio and surface rolled and double printed. This is an example of a barbed wire column. In other words, I had been to Egypt in 1980, and I'd been very impressed by the columns of Luxor. But those columns are of extremely massive stone in their structure. This is a column that's really a drawing, but the drawing material is barbed wire and chain, so that in that sense, it's diagrammatic. Of course, it still plays with other ideas and implications. After all, most of you are city people, and you never had to keep the cows at home, so you never thought barbed wire was anything nice. You know, the cows don't think it's nice either, but this piece is called Homage to the Poet Leon Gontran Damas, and it's, if you don't know who he was, historically, he was one of the writers who was one of the fathers of negritude, along with Leopold Senghor and Aimé Césaire. They were both political thinkers, philosophers, and in terms of literature, very creative people. Damas lived the last 9 years of his life in this country, was a personal friend, had asked me to make a piece of sculpture. He died before it could happen. I made this one in homage of his memory. And this slide is from the Everson Museum in 1981. The piece on the right is a kind of double gateway, or in other words, a sculpture developed from that kind of entry and exit idea, which is one that architects have to deal with. Entries and exits, of course, are important both in the functional and in the spiritual kind of sense. And this is sort of one of several developed while making a much larger piece, and I'll show you that shortly. This is Great Zimbabwe, and is started with a couple of slides earlier. But it's a complex which uses the structure of the geographical or geological structure. And often in art and architecture, at least in my readings, of course, Japan is often given as a great example of, you might say, builders or architects or gardeners who utilize nature as it is and build in the construct. In a complementary manner, and in a creative complementary manner. And I think if you ever saw Great Zimbabwe, and there are several other ruins of similar scale and scope in Zimbabwe. In fact, once they got independence, then the writers could sort of come forth with more information on the kind of stone architecture and terraces and hillside kind of structures which utilize stone in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, and Malawi. And they now estimate that that kind of work is in quantity, not in the sense of a single structure, but in quantity equal to what's in the Great Wall of China. So it's not just a little bit of stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff there. And if we ever get the archaeologists and stuff really working in Africa, then you'll have a whole lot of architectural and the history of civilization will be different just because it's got to be dug up and can be now. I'll run through the Zimbabwe, Great Zimbabwe slides. You see, often I saw so many boulders that were like modern sculpture. I said, man, this is easy. I'm going to just hang out here and do drawing after drawing after drawing, and I don't have to worry about my work changing or developing. It's already there. But, you know, that was always the advice to artists. Take a real good look at nature. Take a real good look at the world around you. Sections that you're seeing, which are very integrated with the large boulders, is the hill complex. And from up there, you can look down and see this large circular enclosure. And that juxtaposition, both of space and place, was very significant, and it's an incredible thing to see. The sculpture on the right is a piece of mine. It's actually owned by Morgan State University in Baltimore, and I made it there during the year of 1976 and 77. However, the photograph of it is taken at the New Jersey State Museum, and well, in formalistic terms, it's a theme and variation based on three circles, but its title probably exposes more of what was in my mind. It's called Homage to Billie Holiday and the Young Ones of Soweto. Billie Holiday was born in Baltimore, and she's a very creative and significant singer. Often, some people like to just say, well, she was a talented jazz singer, and, you know, we like her, but you know what. Well, for me, if you remember that there's a series of pieces that I've worked on called The Lynch Fragments, and I've worked on them for 30 years. Billie Holiday once composed a song which is very expressive based on the same thing, and it's called Strange Fruit. And if you don't listen to that kind of stuff anymore, well, you ought to, because it will tell you a little bit. But more than just that it will tell you something, is when we talk about art in the sense of being expressive, there is some art that really arises to that level, and often there's a lot which you might say tries to but just doesn't quite get there. She's one of those whose work really got it there, in my opinion. Since she was from Baltimore, Morgan State's in Baltimore, and the piece was for an educational institution, I thought it would be good if they knew about somebody from there. I'm sure they already did, but I was just adding a little weight to it. The other thing is that The Young Ones of Soweto, that reference was in the year 1976. That was the year that they had their own uprising. And if there's any change in South Africa at this point, a significant part is due to the activities of very young people in school who are very committed and who many of them lost their lives. They gave up the whole thing. People shot them while they were running and singing and protesting. And when we get to the idea of aesthetics, if aesthetics is something which improves human life, which makes better life, then the aesthetic is not limited to any particular vocation or activity or mode. And therefore, creativity is really in how well you do it, how well you extend the qualities. That's a lot of stuff, a lot of weight on one piece of sculpture, but that's some of my thinking anyway. The group of people on the left, the family of Chief, the late Chief Alfred Basije Osula, who is one of the significant chiefs in Benin, in Nigeria. And Chief Osula was very helpful to me in understanding and corroborating notions I had about real values in traditional life and their potential application for the future. The man on the far left is Daniel Ine, who is the son of the bronze caster I pointed out to you earlier, the late Chief Omoregbe Ine. Well, Daniel Ine